This is the April 23 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Aaron Curtis from Midco out of Bloomington, Illinois, Ellen Dearden from AgriView in Morton, Illinois, Jerry Golke of the Golke Group out of Rockford, Illinois, and Neil Shaw of Neil Shaw, New York, New York. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find and listen to our programming anytime you'd like online at WILLAG.org. That's willag.org. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Neil Shaw. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do there in New York?
Well, Todd, thanks for the introduction. I am currently holed up in my apartment in Manhattan. I haven't left in, I want to say, 3 to 4 weeks. And I spend most of my day looking out the window, hoping I can leave at some point.
Well, I'll ask you about grocery delivery in just a bit, because I think that might have some play for us in the agricultural world in the future. But right now, I want to have you introduce yourself and give us kind of a bio, what you have done over the past few years, and how you play into the ethanol market.
Of course. So I spent most of my career in Houston, Texas, where I was on a physical ethanol trading desk at a shop called Bioroger Trading. I worked with two gentlemen named Jordan Fife and Mark Kasser, and while at Bioroger, we would trade physical and paper ethanol all across the U.S. in various markets like Chicago, New York Harbor, the Midwest, Arizona, you name it. And then I did a stint in New York City, where I was at a hedge fund slash market maker, where I traded ethanol and other various commodity derivatives.
The way I found you was that I had asked a question on Twitter about whether ethanol might be able to trade below zero at some point in the future, as crude oil had, because of the storage problems that both have been suffering through in the recent months. You said, well, you had a longer explanation that ended with no. Why was that the case?
I wouldn't say it's impossible, but improbable. And, you know, while equity guys might be shocked to find negative prices, this isn't relatively new for commodity guys. Natural gas traders will tell you that prompt Waha trades negative on the prompt from time to time. But to sort of break it down, we sort of need to see why crude went negative. And there's sort of two mechanisms in play. First, the physical market, and also the paper market or the futures. So as we all know, there's a huge physical glut of super contango. And due to production, we just have a lot of oil that has nowhere to go. And in a past life, I was a drilling intern for a major oil and gas company. And I'll tell you that you can't really shut off these wells. It can damage them. And in some cases, you are legally required to exhaust a well before shutting it down. So we have one play where we have a lot of production. We have storage that has been rapidly been bid and taken out of play. And then we have the futures market. So what happened Monday was we had expiry for the May contract. And, you know, for the May contract, it was rolling off. And at some point, it would go from a financial obligation to a physical obligation. And as we know, going into expiry, weird things can happen. So we had more open interest and volume than actual space available in Cushing. And keep in mind, this contract will convert to a physical delivery about a couple weeks from now into June. And there just was no space available. So all the longs that were maybe were waiting to roll or thought that they could play the super contango and were completely unaware of the storage space problem had to puke it up. And we temporarily had negative prices. And if you look at it, we had negative prices for just, you know, a few minutes or just, you know, a few duration. And this, it did not trade for the duration of the contract, but we did go negative. So this sort of gets back to the ethanol. So ethanol has a similar issue as crude oil. We have a flood of, you know, inventory. We have record high stocks. I want to say the EIA printed 27.6 on Wednesday, which was the highest of all time since the week before that. Demand has been, I believe they printed 523 for blending and 5311 for gasoline demand, which was the second lowest since the week before that. So we obviously have way too much stocks and a complete decimation of demand. However, the difference is the ethanol physical market is sort of traded on an OTC and bilateral nature through a mechanism or a storage hub called Argo, Chicago. So in Chicago, I want to say near Midway Airport, there's a storage system of about 1.6 million barrels called Kinder Morgan Argo. And this is the Cushing for ethanol. It is where most physical transfers happen. And to be able to trade this on a commercial level, not only do you have to have space there, not only do you have to have credit checks and go through a system to get approved, but you also have to have different controls in there to be able to transact. And there is a EH CBOT future contract, which technically does deliver and can physically settle in Chicago, but simply there, the volume's not there, there isn't enough open interest, and nobody used that. And in addition, on the market mechanism point, let's look at production, supply, and demand for ethanol. By all means, it's out of whack, and we already are, a bit balanced, and we are still building, but Argo still has plenty of space available. From my understanding, it's only 50% full. There's still, tankage space available, and there's still places to put away barrels. So in my opinion, one, we have places that we can, have more contango and send barrels to. Two, there really isn't a retailer version to use the EH contract. And three, the Argo system itself sort of helps limit, them from getting completely full or completely empty. And in my experience, I've traded both sides of it. So I've seen them completely empty. And when that happens, they'll enforce tank bottoms and they'll watch inventory like a hawk, what's coming in and out. And when it gets completely full, they'll do the opposite, where they'll tell people to stop shipping. They'll embargo, the rail yard and help other mechanisms to help put a lid on, growing or decreasing inventory.
I'm wondering whether the rest of you have questions for Neil. Ellen Dearden, I'll start with you.
Yeah, my question is, on the ethanol side, you don't seem to be terribly worried, but is the CFTC and the CME going to go after this crude oil contract? I mean, that was pretty wild on Monday. Will there be some type of an investigation on that, do you suppose?
I don't know, to be honest, but there was a good interview with, the head of the CME, and he reiterated that the market mechanism worked exactly as it was. And once again, this was the May contract rolling off. It was temporarily negative. And once again, there's nothing, crazy. I mean, there's nothing that stops prices from going negative. Once again, if there's too much product and there's no way to get rid of it, just again, like natural gas and other, commodities, you physically pay someone to take care of it. So there might be some, fanfare, but I don't think there'll be an investigation or anything meaningful to come from this. The market mechanism worked as it should have. And in the end of it, there were more sellers than buyers. So the price reflected it.
Jerry Golke, during our commodity week last week, and this was not part of the program, but we did have a discussion, and it was recorded on Thursday, about the CME Group warning somehow traders in some form that there could be some odd trade that would be below zero. Did you see that? And if not, do you have a question for Neil?
I saw something cross through on the email, and we get so much of the stuff. I looked at it and didn't pay a lot of attention to it, other than the fact that CNBC and some of these other stations were news business networks were full of the same thing, saying it could very well go negative, and there wasn't much done about it. It just the important thing was they warned you just to get out of the way if you couldn't stand the heat. And it happened so fast that I think a lot of people missed it.
Yeah, so it happened towards the end of Monday to begin with. And this was, once again, the May contract that was rolling off into expiry. And most of the industry moved to June and July, which, was definitely off, but did not go negative as well. So I think, makes a great headline. It's, interesting, but, this was a tiny, tiny, part of the contract that most of the energy trading industry has sort of shifted towards to the other months beyond that.
Jerry, do you have a question for Neil?
Yeah, just a comment. At that same time, I got a call from my supplier, FS, Farm Service, Farm Bureau supplier, they offered me a tank for free if I just take delivery of some diesel or gasoline. So you knew that there was there was a reason to get rid of it. So in essence, they paid me to take it because I didn't have to buy the tank. But I'm just wondering what Neil's thoughts are long term as to you know, how much of a hit are we going to take? And I've used some numbers, like I thought maybe 1.2 billion bushels of corn would not be used over the next, I guess, from a, I would say a calendar year from, say, March 1 to March 1. Does he see this thing being worse than that? Are we going to cut ethanol, demand for ethanol, I guess, and therefore crushing of corn by 50%, as some people think?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. So I do think that the demand destruction is pretty evident, and we are testing tank tops sort of all across the nation. So, you know, way back when I was in Houston, we would call it whack-a-mole, where when the market was sort of undersupplied or, you know, we had enough demand, it's sort of akin to that carnival game with the moles and the mallet, where a mole pops up, you whack it down. And it used to be where, you know, let's say New York Harbor, which is another pricing point, it sort of got some margin and, you know, pop up in pricing, and the market would hammer it down. And then maybe Chicago would pop up and we would hammer that down. But for the past 2 to 3 years, you know, I'll be frank, ethanol, you know, ethanol margins have been bad. We've been oversupplied. And this wasn't just strictly due to the corona COVID-19 virus. You know, way back in 2016, we ran on average 996 KB a day and stocks were 20.2. And then in 2018, we ran 1045 KB a day and stocks were around 22-ish. And, you know, this was when we had stronger gasoline demand and stronger exports even without China. So you can tell that from the supply and demand side, we have been oversupplied. And this has been manifested in poor margins, you know, for the past year or two. And even before Corona-19, we had negative margins starting in Q1. So this just really accelerated things. We got crushed down to minus 30 and we sort of bounced off that. So to answer your original question, how much demand destruction and do we see, do I see plants starting back up? So it's sort of a twofold question. One, ethanol plants are their own worst enemy. You know, they like to produce, they have been producing for quite some time. And even when margin in Q4 temporarily popped due to massive cutbacks, maintenance, and we actually got the curve to go slightly backwards, we once again overproduced, and by January 2020, we were 4% year over year, and we crushed margins back to the negative. So overall, I do not think that we're going to have a huge recovery in demand immediately. I think we might have maybe a staggered opening, and we're sort of seeing this in a pop in demand last week, but the damage has sort of been done. The good news is, as of now, production seems to be in balance with demand. So I think that's one reason why we haven't really had the curve move as it was supposed to over the past couple of weeks, and we haven't we haven't like had the super contango, because production went from 900 to about, like, you know, 570-ish pretty quickly. So the market was pricing in a lot of production's come on for now. I mean, come off for now, things are balanced. But what worries me, and this is a good question for you guys, is that with corn where it is and corn basis sort of coming off, I know some plants are tempted to start back up. You know, it might be cheaper natural gas, cheap corn basis, corn oil is there, DDGs across the curve aren't that bad. And, you know, I think the biggest threat to the ethanol industry is them starting back up again and, you know, trying to chase after margin. And, you know, to go back into that pricing point about Argo, which is sort of our hub and for a while was sort of insulated from all this oversupply because the ethanol was chasing different tanks across the U.S., New York Harbor, California, you know, Gulf Coast. We're starting to see a shift, and I've been sort of bearish some of these time spreads because while they might have been slightly carry, they still didn't cover the full cost of carry between months, and I thought they were a little rich. And now we saw it today where a bunch of producers came out in the market to sell the physical ethanol in Argo, which sort of tells me that the barrels are headed that way. We have, you know, from my calculations, over 250 rail cars, which is a record, headed to the pricing point. So it seems like plants might be starting back up and chasing margin down and once again causing more bills and might diminish any long-term, you know, recovery.
Well, I just mentioned, Todd, that I think he made a very good point. He says ethanol producers are their own worst enemy. They love to produce. I'm fearful that farmers are the same way. We like to produce.
Yes.
And that may be something that are we really going to shut off corn? You know, this ground's going to get planted by somebody at some price this year and next year and beyond. How do we solve that problem to where corn gets so cheap that the ethanol guy can't afford not to try to produce again?
Yeah, well, here's my question, and I wasn't going to ask this, but I think we've gone down this road far enough that I want to think about it a little bit. One of the things, Neil, that I had tweeted back out after I got your answer was I went back and looked at oil rigs, mostly because you said oil rigs are not as easy to shut down as an ethanol plant, and I thought that seemed odd to me, simply because I knew the oil rig counts go up and down pretty fast sometimes. There is historical numbers for that. They do go down pretty quickly. But what was really obvious in the last year was that oil rig counts around the world, including in Canada, did not go down nearly as much as the oil rig counts in the United States. The U.S. clearly does not have a comparative advantage for whatever reason in the production of crude oil. And I'm wondering if this is an indication that those will be shut down permanently, potentially, and if that rolls over into some of the rest of the marketplace based on number of miles driven and usage of crude oil in general, so that the trend is lower. And I'm don't know whether, Neil, you have an answer for that or not.
That's a good question. I think ultimately the recovery or anything demand-based recovery, you know, there's a concept called pent-up demand. I don't really think it exists. I don't think people, once we get to a full recovery, people are going to drive for the sake of driving. Sure, we might have an uptick and we might have slightly higher, but that demand destruction has been gone. I mean, those barrels are completely off the market. And I think this might be something that takes months, if not years, to recover from. And once again, as you guys mentioned, as long as producers, you know, fight, you know, the urge to come back, we might be able to burn through some of these stocks. But if, as you said, corn basis gets cheaper, we could start back up again and keep these stock inventories where they are. And any jump in demand on the gasoline side, or maybe miles driven, might be for naught.
Aaron Curtis, Poet has shut down a number of plants. They've been cutting back dramatically. Any likelihood that they would open back up?
Well, I mean, if you look at margins like Neil referenced, you know, they have creeped back up a little bit. And like he mentioned, right, we've had a long history, or at least some history, right, of plants continuing to grind in conditions that margins would be negative as long as they can kind of cover variable cost. We've seen a couple plants in the Western Corn Belt that have kind of ramped back up here a little bit or kind of fired back up here in the recent days here. So I think his concern on that is valid, that we are seeing probably some interest in maybe creeping back up here a little bit. It's been kind of interesting to see, at least on the front end of some of these wet mill plants out in Iowa. We've had a couple plants too that have firmed up their near-term basis after that, that fall we saw here about a month ago when everybody across the Corn Belt, at least on the ethanol side, really just whacked nearby bases. But we've seen some, general steady to some inputs for some of these plants as they continue to, you know, try to add back to some near-term supplies, probably with the margins somewhat improving, obviously still negative, but some improvement. But also the fact that the farmer has gone to the field, and especially to the Western Corn Belt, basis tends to have a somewhat historical upside pattern here in this April-May timeframe when farmer goes to the field and we have less truck traffic available and those kind of things. So it has been kind of interesting to watch at least some stabilization in near-term basis at some of the ethanol plants, especially from Illinois to the west. Now, we haven't really seen that as much to the east as we continue to see basis continue to be fairly weak. But the other interesting thing is, you know, some of these plants obviously are making hand sanitizer, and that's also helped to drive a little bit of profitability, at least for those that can play in that market, Todd.
Ellen Dearden, you've been listening pretty intently to this. I'm wondering what you think about the plants opening up, taking more corn in, and whether that's good or bad over the long run?
I would love to see it. As a farmer, I would love to see all these plants open up, but I don't think it's in the cards. I'm hearing more and more guys in the northwestern Corn Belt saying that they've been told by their ethanol plants that they've got contracted corn for June and July that don't expect to be able to deliver then. So I'm not thinking that a lot of these are going to reopen. I think the farmer-owned ones that have been able to make money over time will stay open as much as they can, primarily to service their own stockholders and provide DDGs to them.
I suppose, Ellen, it brings me to the idea of whether we'll put 97 million acres in the ground. If they're getting that kind of pressure in the Northwest, and North Dakota already says they're not going to plant nearly as many corn acres as they had last year. They have a whole bunch of problems left over from last year. Can we get the 97 million?
I don't know. I've often thought that was pretty rich. The boys in Kansas tell me they're going to be planting a lot less corn this year. Even though they've got good moisture conditions, they're going to plant more Milo because the basis is so good again for that for export market. Sunflowers has also been a popular crop there. They won't plant as much corn this year. But I think Indiana and Illinois probably will increase corn acres. And I just hope that we stay at 97 million corn acres and we don't go to 98, given the open weather situation for a lot of these fellas.
Jerry Gulkey, what's your thought on acreage?
Well, you know, we do our own survey, and initially, right off the taking the information verbatim, we said that corn acres could go to 96 to 97 million acres, but I didn't believe it. So we didn't print that formally. We thought more like 94.7, something in that area. I think given the weather and given the idea that we've got a market carry, and, you know, a lot of times farmers look at it and say, look what it's worth for December versus now. And if you have on-farm storage, you can you have a profit enhancement to capture that carry. So I doubt that we get much more than 1.5 million acres less. Except that North Dakota, you know, they planted close, I think, 3.5 million acres, something like that. I think their acres up there could be down 1 million acres. And I'm not so sure about the people in Ohio and Indiana. We have clients in Ohio that are already trying to move some corn to beans because their basis fell apart. I just talked to a client in Northwest Iowa. They moved another 800 acres to soybeans and maybe more, he said, depending. He farms about 8,000 acres, and I know in North Dakota we're cutting our corn acres down a lot. We certainly are tired of combining into January and wet corn and low test weight stuff. So I would say I doubt very much that we're going to get above that 97 million acre mark and probably 2 million acres less at most. And because there's still that feeling out there that I can produce more corn than my APH. So that mitigates, more bushels mitigates some of the price deterioration. And we all remember Ag Secretary saying, if you don't plant, you don't get. So if we're going to be getting some kind of payments because of a market distortion, the concept might be we get a good corn payment going into election time, and that may keep these this production. There's nothing in the government payments to stop us from producing. Because we want to keep, or the government wants to keep, the seed guys, the herbicide guys, and the banks happy to keep the price of grain at least relatively stable so we don't put this thing in deterioration. So I think it is what it is. We've got to have too much corn and too much beans probably before this is over.
Aaron Curtis, the marketplace did get pretty excited at one point this week on the idea that the Chinese would be in need of refilling their stockpiles of both corn and soybeans in order to ensure their food supply.
Yeah, the rumors were 10 million metric tons of beans, 20 million metric tons of corn, and 1 million metric tons of cotton was kind of the rumor circulating in the last 24 hours or something. It'd be a pretty rare event for China to come out in advance of what they're going to do and tell or leak or whatever what they're going to do ahead of time. So that would be an interesting exercise for them to do that, because that would be pretty rare. But, you know, we have seen a couple announcements here the last couple days on soybean sales, old crop to China. You know, we are fairly competitive in that August-September time frame with Brazil, you know, some 80-85% sold from the producer there. So, the, you know, exportable supplies are going to continue to dwindle for them on the bean side as we move through the summer. So it looks like at least maybe on the export side, we could be returning to a little bit more of a standard pattern on beans, where, you know, China was typically involved in the U.S. markets in late summer, early fall, and that seems to be back to a little bit more of a standard program than what we've seen the last couple of years. The corn side, typically we watch the cash market to give it, right, if there's anything coming down the pipe. And if you look at CIF values this week, they've been pretty quiet. We did see some business a couple weeks ago, saw CIF values perk up a little bit, even up through some Illinois River terminals, but that market is quickly faded again, with CIF values near term anyway, or nearby, trading in that mid to upper 40s number, and, you know, fallen kind of South American values a little bit weaker here in the last week or two. So at least on God, we haven't seen any indications that China's really looking for any sort of U.S. corn at this point.
Ellen Dearden, I know you watch the livestock sector closely. The supply chain has been really strained, as the number of calories that people get from the grocery store has changed. The Secretary of Agriculture, when announcing the direct payments that would be made as part of the CARES Act during the press conference on Friday evening, pointed out that about half of the calories that U.S. citizens consume come outside of the home. How stressed is the supply chain? Can it change quickly enough to adapt to what's been a larger grocery supply need than has been around for decades now?
It's been very difficult, primarily because the way the carcasses get broken down for the retail is different than the way they get broken down for the wholesale market or the restaurant market. But, I mean, the whole thing is backed up. We've got every day that we're not killing, you know, 100,000 cattle, you know, just puts us behinder and behinder, as they say. It's kind of like the ethanol market. You know, when you lose that demand for gasoline and ethanol, you know, you can't make that up. Well, it's pretty difficult to make up these kill schedules, too, you know, when we're down 19% in the hogs right now on the plants that are down, just totally down. And I think that it's a major, major issue.
It, it puts short supply up front, meaning grocery store shelves are in need, though that we've seen that, but it's not been horrible to this point. And I don't see that that's going to happen.
Part of that, Todd, is because there's so much stuff in frozen warehouses. The cold storage report that came out this past week showed, you know, the amount of meat, red meat in cold storage was actually pretty high. I mean, we were up on the pork side of things. We were up 2% from a year ago. Beef, we were up 11% from a year ago. So we've got stuff in storage. That's what we're pulling out right now to ship to grocery stores, or a lot of that is. So, but that fresh product, that's gonna come to bite us.
All right. Well, first, it's backing up at this point, and they're just not going to go into the breeding schedule. I assume beef has the biggest problem with this.
Yes, I would say so. Hogs, by the sheer numbers, have a huge problem. But, you know, beef backs up quickly.
Because you keep track of this so closely, and I've thought about this some, because the poultry, well, all three of them are fairly vertically integrated. They don't tend to change on the margin very much anymore, I don't think, the number of animals that are going through the system. So I would assume this really throws a monkey wrench into everything.
Yep, it does. Absolutely, it does. Major, major problem.
Yep. Will it show up in feed usage in the fall?
Well, the pork and beef guys are trying to change rations around to slow down growth. So So this backup of numbers isn't going to be backup of elephants coming out of the feedlots or elephants coming out of the barn. So maybe we won't see a big change in feed, because at the tail end of things, you're not feeding as much corn as you are in the middle of the growth period. So I don't know. You know, I haven't been a believer in USDA feed numbers for years, so I'm not the right person to ask and be civil about it.
So more days on a leaner diet of, but they'll have more days of corn or whatever.
Correct.
The feed.
Yeah.
Okay. Jerry, have you been thinking about this one too?
Yeah, and I wonder whether we're not going to see such a sharp cut in hog production in that Dune report, that Dune 30's report that tells us that feed usage is going to have to be ratcheted down henceforth in the fall, which now we got a double whammy of feed usage and ethanol usage. And I don't see the numbers getting bigger. I just talked to a friend of mine in Northwest Iowa, a hog producer, and he said there was a lot of buildings planned. And he said all but one, I think the one cement outfit had 20-some facilities planned. All but one have been canceled. And there's been some that were partially done, and they've stopped production on them. So the expansion for hogs has really been curtailed. And we should probably see that in the June 30th report.
Neil, I'll come back to you at this point. You've been in Manhattan, locked down really hard for 4 weeks now. You haven't been out. Are you getting groceries delivered?
I tried to do that originally, but as usual, all the delivery slots have been filled up. So, you know, every now and then I put on my mask and go out into the wild wilderness that is Manhattan and go to my local grocery store and get, you know, forage for food and try to make it week by week.
Have you been finding everything you wanted?
Actually, yes. So before the stay-at-home what announcement was there, I did go by the local Trader Joe's or other grocery stores, and they didn't have anything there. It was sort of all that was left was, I don't know, like cauliflower or random things. But now I think due to less traffic and them, you know, having more resupply, the shelves have everything that's available. I will say that there has been a limitation on how much frozen meat you can take. Usually it might be just one or two, and there have been some limitations on frozen foods. I'm not sure if that's a local thing for my grocery store or that's ubiquitous, but they do look at that.
Do you think that there will be a large change in the number of people that eat at restaurants over the long term?
You know, I can't speak for the rest of the country, but, you know, as a, you know, New Yorker, probably. I mean, even if they, you know, lifted a stay-at-home notice, I'm not going to go rush to, like, a restaurant or a crowded restaurant. I'll definitely go to a bar, but that's just because the ethanol market has been what it is for the past couple of weeks. But yeah, I mean, I'm not going to go to a crowded place. I think I'm going to be a little bit more, careful about where I eat. I'll definitely dine out, but it won't be the same eating out every day, not to mention the whole recession and other concerns that are, you know, on the horizon. So I personally think people will tighten up the belt a little bit and try to avoid overly human contact, which in New York is hard to do.
Okay, so I'm going to take a vote on this, and then we'll get our final word from each of you. Aaron, do you think that you will continue to eat? I don't know how much each of you eat out at restaurants. My guess is that my wife and I will go back to restaurants. Ellen, how about you?
Well, I'm a cook-at-home type farm wife, so I'm probably not the right person to ask, but I think things will look very different in a month or however, whenever things reopen versus 3 months versus a year from now. So I think a year from now, things will be right back to where they were in, say, the 1st of March.
Aaron Curtis?
Yeah, I think if you watch some of the conversations around China and now Germany, right, it's been pretty slow for those folks to go back and sit down in a restaurant. And I would assume that'll happen a little the same way here in the United States. It'll be a slow process until you know, either we have some sort of remedy or some sort of vaccine to allow people to feel much safer. I know there'll be some areas, right, that kind of return maybe to something a little more normal, but as a country as a whole, I think it'll be a somewhat slow process.
I should make note that in Champaign County, and I don't know whether this is still the case or not, but we used to be the number one place in the United States for eating out per capita at restaurants. Jerry Golke, how about you?
Well, I find it really disheartening that I'm out here on the farm and I love to go to Greasy Spoons for eggs, toast, and hash browns in the morning or have a cup of coffee. I can't do that. I can take it out, so instead of taking it out, I cook it at home quick and grab a bite. And so I'm one of those that would love to go back to the ways of the we had before, but it may take some time. And I think the restaurants will probably dictate, you know, well, how this is going to happen with distances between tables and that type of thing to make us feel better. So I'm with the rest of the group. I'm hoping this thing comes back, but I think it'll be gradual. I just hope we're not planting another crop before we see this thing back to normal.
Let's wrap up. I'll get a final word from each of you. Aaron Curtis from Midco in Bloomington, Illinois. Let's start with you this afternoon.
Well, continue to wish safe thoughts to everybody out there, especially those that continue to plant here and in the fields, continue to be safe. I think as we look forward here, especially in that May crop report, right, when we get our first look at the new balance sheet, expected to lean to the negative side here on corn especially. So I think for those that still have some grain to price, the outlook at least for demand and also with a big crop coming doesn't look very friendly here moving forward. So continue to use some balances to help clean up some of your old crop corn if we get it and be somewhat proactive if we start to see some continued green on the screen here.
You know, we'd managed to not say that this whole show, Aaron. Ellen Dearden from Ag Review out of Morton, Illinois. Your final word, please.
We rallied corn this week about 20 cents, and we did something very similar last year. Just prior to the May deliveries, we rallied 21 cents in corn. And then we took another break before we actually rallied in that June high that we made in 2019. I think this market is not going to be a straight up affair, but buying dips rather than selling rallies for the next month or 6 weeks is probably a good bet in corn.
Jerry Golke of the Golke Group out of Rockford, Illinois.
Yeah, we have a little difficult time than most perhaps because we were lucky enough to get a lot of the grain hedged. And I looked at our hedge position on our farm and I said, you know, I almost have as much made hedging as I thought I was going to make for the year, which tells you how bad things are. And there was a point where I said, you know, we haven't planted a kernel of corn yet. Maybe it's time just to stand aside and let time pass. But then when I look out into the carry, and, you know, this year we could have some very large carries due to the new way of calculating things. You look at May to May, and there's quite a carry in this, and I think that may be where the opportunities are. When you look out and you're 40 to 50 cents higher a year from now, I'm more apt to sell a call out there than I am to buy a call up front hoping for a rally, because I think the same thing, that this thing is going to be a slow process going up. I will say that I've got an unerring feeling about the weather, and you know, it feels dry to me. I haven't seen dust fly in field cultivating a field for quite a time in the spring. And you look at Europe, you look at Russia, North Dakota's got planting problems. Maybe we'll open up a better opportunity for some prevent plant in some of those states that would love to just not plant this year because of price. So I want to go with the same person that took me to the dance. And if I get by signals from a technical standpoint, and Todd knows that I look at technicals quite a bit, I will be more than ready to lift hedges and stand aside.
And finally, Neil Shaw out of New York, New York. I love the way that rolls off, by the way.
Thank you.
Very nice.
Well, look, I continue to be bearish on the ethanol market. I think some of the carry spreads were a little, you know, didn't reflect pool carry for the past couple of weeks, but the ethanol market can learn a lot from what happened to the oil market. We have the last hub, which is Argo, that's going to get flooded with rail cars, which started to happen today. So it'll get flooded like memes in a WhatsApp group. And from what you guys are telling me about, you know, a huge crop out there and, you know, the specter of cheap corn basis, I think that might tempt some of these plants to start back up. And with the ethanol market, it's supply and demand. Unfortunately, the demand isn't there, and we've been oversupplied for way too much. So I continue to be bearish.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may hear the whole of the program anytime you'd like on our website at willag.org. That's willag.org. Our thanks go to our panelists this week, including Aaron Curtis from Midco, Ellen Dearden of Ag Review, Jerry Golke of the Golke Group, and Neil Shaw from Neil Shaw. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.